All right, so our topic is going to be Noah's Ark. Could it be true? Could it possibly actually be true? All right, and I hope to show you some evidence to say that it is. So this is going to be, I think, a fairly unique sermon. You may have never heard anything like this, and you may not hear much like it again. So hopefully it'll be interesting for you. Anyway, the Bible, is it a book of science? Well, no, not really. But you know what? When the Bible touches on a scientific topic, it ought to speak the truth, right? Because the Bible is truth. So here's just one little teaser example on that. In Jonah, it says that he went to the roots of the mountains. He sank down in the water to the roots of the mountains. But you know what? That was written in 860 BC. There were no submarines then. So how was this known? Obviously, it was a supernatural revelation, you know, put into the Bible. So here's a scientific fact that was not known at that time, but a very true statement. So the Bible may not be a book of science, but is it a book of history? The answer is yes, it is. Really, that is one of the main purposes of the Old Testament, is it not? To say, what is the history from the beginning of time up through the time of Jesus Christ? It is definitely a book of history. So here are some of the major biblical early history events, things like the creation of the universe by God, which I believe was over seven 24-hour days, the fact that there was a perfect Garden of Eden, real people named Adam and Eve who first lived there, that they sinned. This is called the fall of man. And at that point, God cursed then mankind. And most people don't realize he actually cursed the creation at that same time also, so that it was no longer perfect. After that comes the great flood in Noah's Ark, and that's what we're going to be focusing on today. And according to the Bible, this occurred about 4,500 years ago. After the flood was the Tower of Babel, where God had to disperse the people. Why? Because he told them to repopulate the earth and no one was going anywhere. So he had to make them leave. And then there was the Exodus, the conquest of Canaan. So all of these are events recorded in the Bible. But you know what? All of these things are doubted. And they're not just doubted a little bit. They're doubted a whole lot by secular scientists, historians, philosophers, etc. All of these things are very much in doubt, according to them. Unfortunately, even many Christians doubt these things. So here's a website, for example, that's been a bit in the news lately, the BioLogos Forum. Let me read from you. It says, the BioLogos Foundation is a group of Christians, many of whom are professional scientists, biblical scholars, philosophers, theologians, pastors, and educators. We believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God, but we also believe that evolution, properly understood, best describes God's work of creation. Now, I don't know what Bible they're reading, but it certainly doesn't seem like the Bible that I read. And so this is very dangerous teaching. Maybe the most doubted, though, of those historical events is, in fact, the Great Flood. The Great Flood was totally rearranged the earth. You know, when you had a Windows computers, it's gotten better, right? Windows 7 is not too bad, but in the olden days, you'd be working, and then just nothing works anymore. What did you have to do at that point? The computer had a reset button. You push the reset button, things restart and clear up and are working well again. Well, essentially, in Noah's flood, God pushed the reset button on planet Earth to start over. That's the way I like to think of it. But here's a website, Answers in Creation, bringing the Bible and science together without conflict. Was there a global flood? Well, this is probably the biggest question I get asked, and it will be a short answer to such a big question, but no. So, in fact, many Christian organizations, Christian scholars, and believe it or not, even most Christian colleges and universities do not teach Noah's flood as actual history. And I think that this is a sad thing. If they teach it at all, they teach it was just some kind of a local flood, because Noah, he looked as far as he could, and it was water. Okay, I guess it's covering, you know, the whole earth. But this shouldn't surprise us, because it was actually predicted way back in biblical times, right? If we look in 2 Peter, it says this. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming that he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. And look at this last sentence. By these waters also, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. So it's not a surprise that this is the environment today. This was predicted 2,000 years ago that this would maybe the most doubted of the historical events. Well, let's take a brief tour here of the biblical background of the flood, which is described in Genesis chapter 6 through 9. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth. I find that interesting. Of course, God can look forward in time, and he knew that this was going to happen, but he made man anyway, yet he was still grieved when the time finally came. Very interesting. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood, because I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for all of them. This is serious business, folks. Very serious business. In the history of the earth, there was not a more serious event for mankind or for the earth itself than this flood that is described here. Very, very serious business. But what do we do with this? We make a silly caricature out of it, right, in our books for children. And how much do you ever hear about the flood after about the third grade? And you certainly never hear anything looking at the flood seriously, I don't believe, like we're trying to do here this morning. Here's a little book, for example. Noah's Ark. Look, there's a smiling Noah on the front and some happy animals with their heads sticking out of the roof. Now, you wonder why do secular people not take the flood seriously? Well, it's because we don't even believe it ourselves. We really don't. Most Christians do really not believe that this took place. This was some of the most serious business to ever happen on the earth, but yet we treat it as a cartoon, as a caricature, and we rarely talk about it. So hopefully this morning we're going to learn some things about this. Now, the first thing we want to note is the ark was not really a boat. It was not going anywhere in particular. It had no sails or oars. It had no rudder. The goal of the ark was to have a place for people and animals and to float for really less than 1 year. So in that regard, it's really more like a barge. It's not really a boat. Now, if we look at the biblical account, we will see that Noah actually had about 100 years to plan for this. So this was no rush job. Sometimes we think to ourselves, oh, God says, oh, the flood is coming. Oh, my gosh, I better get going. I hope I can get there in time. No. This was no rush job. There was a lot of planning and that took place. And think about this. If Noah and his family were the only righteous people on the earth at that time, you would have to believe that God blessed them. In other words, they were probably rich with cattle and possessions and things, right? So Noah could have easily hired help in doing this task. And people probably looked at him as, oh, he's the crazy old rich guy. Right? The crazy old rich guy. But, you know, if he wants to pay me to build this big boat or things that go in it, that's fine. I'll take his money. Now, maybe Noah's life, though, was something like this. What did God really mean by building an ark? You know, experts say a flood like that could never happen. And you'll never fit all those animals in the ark. You don't think God will send a literal flood, do you? An ark's a silly idea. So maybe he had to live with these kind of comments every day, right? But you know, God did give him specific specifications for the ark, and some of them are listed here. It was to be 437 feet long, 73 feet wide, 44 feet high, with three decks, a door in the side, and a window running around the top. And when you think about it, that makes sense, right? Because you would need some way for ventilation and for light to get in there. So there had to be some kind of opening like that. It was to be made out of gopher wood, which we believe was teak or maybe some other kind of hardened wood, sealed with pitch inside and out. In other words, some kind of tar-like material, right? So it would be waterproof. You would need that. Just to give you an idea of the size, it's about 1.5 football fields in length. All right, so that is a pretty big boat. All right, let's look at some of the events of the flood, as talked about in the Bible here. I've related it to a modern timeline. On February 10th, Noah, his family, and the animals enter the ark. 1 week later, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and rain falls for 40 days and 40 nights. If we just stop there for a second, this is interesting, isn't it? So they get on the boat, and nothing happens. Right? Nothing happens for 7 days, and I'm sure all the people around there are laughing their heads off at that point about, you know, this silly business that's going on here. But think about this. You know, you're going to put animals into a confined space and even the people into a confining space. Give them some time to acclimate in that environment before all heck breaks loose, right? So this is a smart thing to give some time here. It says after that that the floodwaters came onto the earth for 150 days. The ark comes to rest on the mountains of Ararat, and after that, the waters start to recede. Now it's October 1st. The tops of the mountains become visible. November 9th, Noah sends out a raven, and it returns. Okay, so there's no good place yet to go. 7 days later, he sends out a dove, brings back an olive leaf. Aha, there's something happening out there, some bit of dry land. 7 days later, he sends a dove out again, doesn't come back. He's found himself a good home, happy there. All right. Finally, on January 1st, the waters dried up from the earth. 2 months later, February 27th, the earth was completely dry and the ark unloads. Interesting. They actually waited 2 months on the ark after the waters had dried up. And I can just picture this, right, that the wives and the sons, every day they're saying, can we get off this thing now? Noah, can we get off now? It's been like, can we get off this thing? I'm tired of being in here. You say, no, not yet, not yet. So for 2 months, you know, they're waiting in there, and finally they're given permission to go off. But why is that? Well, think about this. You're releasing a bunch of animals. They're going to need something to eat, right? You got to give time for that plant material to grow so that they have some food. So once again, makes a lot of sense. If we look back at to the beginning here, we're going to see later a slide that shows there was actually a lot of room on the ark, and we believe that it was open, really, for everyone to enter. There was plenty of space inside. Everyone was likely to be invited in. So Noah, I imagine, for 100 years was telling people, hey, judgment is coming, judgment is coming. Why don't you come on to the ark with us and join us? But you know what? He didn't make any converts, did he? Didn't make anyone convinced of what was going to happen. They were so self-assured, I guess, of their own ways and enjoying their sin that, hey, you know, for them it wasn't something believable. But we believe that there was room in there for many more. So here's a picture of what it really looked like. Once again, a very, very bad time. Not a happy day at the zoo. Not a happy day at the floating zoo, but instead a terrifying day for certainly the people not on the ark, and even the people on the ark, I'm sure, were still pretty terrified with all that was going on. Now, many people believe that it was just a local flood, but why does it not make sense for it to be a local flood? Well, first of all, Genesis says everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. And it also says in the Bible that the floodwaters covered the tops of the mountains. And think about this. Well, Noah could have simply moved somewhere else. He had plenty of time. And why would you save animals when they existed just a couple of hundred miles away, right? It doesn't make any sense at all. So if it was a local flood that covered the mountains, maybe it looks something like this. Somehow I don't think so. But you know what? Maybe one of the most compelling reasons for not being a global flood is this, God's promise. Let's read about this in Genesis chapter 9. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. Seems like a very nice promise. Oh, look at this. Hey, look at the beautiful rainbow. It's a promise from God that he'll never again flood the entire earth as he did in Noah's day. But my Christian college professor says that Noah's flood didn't cover the entire earth. You mean he said it was just a localized flood? Yeah, that's what he said. So he believes God promised to never again send a localized flood. And I'm sure the people along the Mississippi River could relate to this, could they not? Now, shifting gears a bit, in school you all learned about this, the geologic time column. This has the supposed history of life throughout millions of years divided into different eras. One of the eras on there, for example, is the Jurassic era, about 60, 70 million years ago. This is where the title of the film Jurassic Park came from, right? Because it's the time of the dinosaurs. The time of the dinosaurs. So let's put this geologic column to the test a bit. One place we can do that is at Grand Canyon, because here's a place on the Earth where many layers of the Earth are exposed and you have easy access to them. So the question is, was this caused by a little flow of water over a very long time, which is the standard answer, or could it possibly be a lot of water over a very short time? Well, when one looks at this, you have to remember that the answer you get depends on your starting point. So we have Grand Canyon data. We have rocks. But those rocks do not come with labels, right? The data has to be interpreted via a theory which involves certain assumptions and biases. And you know what? If you start with an assumption that evolution is true, you're going to look in the Grand Canyon and you are going to see evolution, right? Because you're going to see increasing orders of complexity of animals as you go to higher layers. But if you start with an assumption of creation and Noah's flood as a real event, you're going to look at that exact same data and you are going to see great evidence for the flood. So the evidence does not speak for itself. You have to interpret that evidence in light of a theory and a bias that you have. This idea that there are unbiased scientists with white lab coats, that's a myth, okay? No one is like that. We all have our biases. So we have these two different views of the geologic column. On the left, the idea of evolution, that this shows increasingly higher orders of various life forms and animals over time. But on the right, we have the flood view of this, which I think makes a lot of sense. In fact, if there was a global flood and you were to ask yourself, what would the result of that look like? It would look exactly like this. So we start at the bottom. You would expect to find some rock layers that have no fossils, and then suddenly we start getting fossils. That would be the boundary before the flood and after the flood. That boundary exists. It's called the Cambrian layer. Below that, there's no fossils. They have the Cambrian explosion, where suddenly many types of life forms are said to have come into existence at the same time. Let's look at the bottom, simpler shaped items. So think about this. You have a bag of potato chips that you've brought home from the store, right? You open the bag up. Where are the crumbs? They're on the bottom, right? You never find the crumbs on the top. The crumbs are on the bottom. Why is that? Because there's a sorting that's taking place as the shaking, right? The small stuff goes to the bottom. Same thing here is called hydrologic sorting. As the floodwaters are going along, the small streamlined things, they are going to fall to the bottom and be buried first, right? And then think about this. As the floodwaters rise, it's first going to inundate things living near the edge of the ocean, and then things that are near the ocean, and then different habitats as the waters rise. So this gives then an appearance of, you know, of a type of evolution happening, but it's just an artifact of how the floodwaters are rising. Maybe the most interesting, though, is there on the top right, more mobile, smarter animals. Think about this. Who are going to be the last creatures to get buried? It's going to be the ones that can run the fastest and get out of the way. The ones that are smartest to recognize there's floodwaters coming, I better get to a higher spot. So in fact, it is the most advanced animals that would take the longest to be drowned, and therefore they would be buried at the top, right? So this is exactly what you would expect if there was a global flood. So I will claim that the geologic column is exactly what you would expect from a global flood and is certainly the superior explanation to the other alternative of it showing an evolution over time. But once again, it gets back to your starting assumptions, right? But if we start with the Bible and the flood being real history, we expect to have this result take place. Mount St. Helens, you might remember, for those of you old enough, 1980, it erupted. What you may not know is that as a result of that, a 1/40th scale Grand Canyon was formed in a matter of days, if not hours, in some places. And in that rock strata, it actually has layering. It has layering of all the different sediments. So the point is, these layers do not have to represent a yearly cycle of, say, drought and rain and those sort of things. But instead, these form naturally as water moves, this layering effect. And we have a perfect example. Geologists were actually shocked at this result. It was completely unexpected. I really like this, polystrate tree. So here we have a vertical fossil of a tree extending through what are supposedly millions of years of layering. But obviously, a tree does not live millions of years. So what does this show you? It shows you that the idea that these layers represent millions of years is really a myth. It's a fantasy, right? Because you cannot have one tree growing there for millions of years. So polystrate fossils, quite interesting. Living fossils, there's many examples of living fossils. Here's one, the coelacanth fish. It was supposedly extinct for over 65 million years. It was touted as an evolutionary transitional form. But then in the 1930s, someone found one living in the Indian Ocean, and they've found many more of them since then. And you know what? It hadn't changed at all. They looked at the oldest fossil, the coelacanth fish, the living one. It looked exactly the same. That's why they call it the living fossil. But there's many, many examples of living fossils, both plants and animals. What does it tell you? It says, well, maybe there weren't really millions of years there, right? That's what it says. How about this? The soft bending of rock strata. I give you some people there for a size reference. If all of those layers of rocks represent millions of years, well, hard rock does not bend, right? Rock has to be soft to bend, obviously. So what does that tell you? It tells you that all of these layers occurred right around the same time, right? Because it had to be hot, it had to be soft, it had to bend. And rocks do not stay hot and bendable for very long. How about this? Fossil graveyards are found in many places around the world. Hey, it's like a flood came and washed all of these animals into a low spot and they got buried. Other people would have you believe that there was a pit there and a whole bunch of really stupid animals just came and they all fell into it. You know, I'm not buying that. I know some animals are not so bright, but I don't think they're all just going to be, falling into a pit like that. How about this? Here's the bristlecone pine tree. It's the oldest known living thing. These live in California. And if you date these with tree rings, you find that they go back around 4,000 years. Some debate on these things. But certainly the date of this, the age of this, is very consistent with the oldest thing being around the time of the flood, around 4,000, 4,500 years ago. How about some other things? Grand Canyon, Planation Service. Look at the top of the Grand Canyon. It's really flat. How do you get a flat land surface? Well, there's really only one way that you get it. It's called the sheeting action of water, right? You get water, it runs along, and it planes the surface, right? That's why they call it a planation service. And we believe for the Grand Canyon that took place as the floodwaters were receding, right? It made a flatness there. But some of that water got dammed up, and when that dam burst, it all rushed out, and it carved out the Grand Canyon, just like Mount St. Helens carved out a smaller version of it. If you look at, example, in Africa, like the Serengeti Plain, 40% of the African continent is a flat plain. And like I say, the only way you get a flat plain is through water sheeting action. This is taking place on a grand scale, right? You do not get that kind of thing out of, other than, I believe, a global catastrophe. How about this? Worldwide flood traditions. You know, many places you go in the world and you look at their history, they will have recollections of the flood. There may be some details and the differences in the story, but they all have a past recollection of this disaster. And like any other story that gets passed down, right, any other historical account that gets passed down, you know, it gets distorted over time. Many people will say, oh, well, they got this from the missionaries. Well, most of these, they predate missionary contact. But is an ark even feasible? Well, this fellow, John Woodmerappy, he has studied this in this book. 1,200 references. The guy's actually a pretty amazing fellow. I've met him. But he equates the ark to modern intensive farming environments, you know, like raising pigs or chickens, because that's was more like that, right? It's not just a floating zoo. I mean, they had to be very careful on how things were done. So who exactly was on the ark? Well, there were land mammals, reptiles, birds, yeah, dinosaurs, yes. We believe dinosaurs were on the ark, amphibians, many animals that are now extinct, and eight people, Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their three wives. The interesting thing is that he really needed to take not representatives of every species, but instead representatives of each of the created kinds, which are at a higher level. So we don't need every species. We need each of the created kinds. Things can diversify some within a created kind. That is not evolution. That is a design to allow flexibility in different environments. Who was on the ark? Well, John Woodmerappy says it could be up to around 16,000 animals, but could have been as few as even 2,000. The average size, the median size, was like a small rat, and only 11% were larger than a sheep. And there were none of those big giraffes. Think about this. These animals have to repopulate the world. You're not going to bring grandpa to do that. You're going to bring a teenage stud guy, right? So they would not be as big. So there were no gigantic giraffes sticking their heads out the top of the ark, right? That's all ridiculous. And we said that these folks were smart, right? Maybe smarter than we were. And they had plenty of time to do things right. So they probably put together many labor-saving type devices like this, where you could put animals in there and they kind of just, you know, care for themselves. You may have to put some food in there once in a while, but, you know, a lot of the work is taken for you if you do it smart, just like they do in intensive farming environments, right? If you're raising pigs and chickens and those sorts of things, you do it in a smart way. How about the inventory of the ark? Well, we know what the estimate, what the empty ark weighed, how much the animals weighed, the food and water that would be needed. The important point here is if you calculate it out, about one-third of the ark could have been extra spare capacity. So there was plenty of room for others who wanted to join in. And you know what? Maybe they did have that exercise ring, right? They had some room. Maybe they had a soccer field. I don't know. But they had a lot of space. How about the gathering of the animals? Well, first we have to remember that animals only started to fear humans after the flood. God instilled that after the flood was over in Genesis 9. Also, the animals were originally created vegetarians, were they not? So you didn't have to worry as much that they were going to bite your hand off. The migration instinct was introduced at this point. It says in the Bible that God drew the animals to the ark. We believe he did that by introducing the migration instinct. We also believe he introduced the hibernation instinct at that point. It would have been very easy to care for animals that are asleep during the whole trip, right? And hibernation and migration, there is no evolutionary explanation for these things. These are complete mysteries, right, of how these kinds of things could have developed, but they make perfect sense in a Bible history view. Also, you've seen these charts where the continents, you know, they really do all fit together like a puzzle. So before the flood, it could have been that there was really just one continent where animals were more evenly distributed because there was a warm climate throughout. We know from studies that there has been, you know, even, you know, warm climate plants are found in the Arctic, et cetera. So the whole Earth at one point was of a warm climate nature. So what we think happened was at the start of the flood, maybe comets came, hit the Earth, that helped, crack the plates and start the fountains of the deep going. And you've heard of plate tectonics. Well, some Christian scientists theorize, well, it's plate tectonics, yes, but just on a a faster scale, maybe moving faster. Today they say those plates move very slow, but there's no reason why they couldn't have moved faster. And if you ask the question, what about after the flood? You had a perfect condition now for an ice age to occur. Think about this. You had cooler land because it's been stripped of its vegetation. You have warmer oceans because the fountains of the deep, the hot water inside the earth has come up. If the plates are moving, there's friction that's generating heat. You have a lot of volcanic dust in the air. You put all these conditions together, what do you expect? You expect an ice age. And interestingly, secular climate folks, they really have no model to adequately predict why we should have had ice ages. But the Bible predicts it as a part of a global flood. If we look back at the historical records, we even see some interesting things. Several years ago, a book came out called After the Flood by Bill Cooper. What he did is he went into the libraries of Europe, into the old dusty archives, and he was actually able to find written history showing, going all the way from the current times back to Noah and Noah's sons. And what this does is it really shows the accuracy of Genesis chapters 10 and 11. Now, this may be hard to read, but here's one of the diagrams from his book. He has Noah at the top going down to Brutus, first king of Britain, and showing how all of what the reigns of the different kings were. But it's not just one either. He's actually found five different sequences that all, from different sources, that all give the same information. So this is quite an interesting result. You see, secular historians, they don't even look for this because they don't believe it. But here, Bill Cooper, he went and he looked for it and he found it in the archives of Europe. Now, if none of this has convinced you so far, how about this? Jesus himself viewed the flood as real history. In Matthew 24, 36, starting there, it says, "But about that day or hour, no one knows." Now, isn't that interesting? You know, I wasn't worried about yesterday and what was going to happen. Why? Because I know this verse, right? About that day and hour, no one knows. And if Jesus doesn't know and says that no one knows, well, then no one knows, right? So if someone tries to tell you they know, you know that they're wrong, right? And you don't need to worry about that. "Not even the angels in heaven or the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man." So Jesus was not referring to this as some kind of story. He's referring it to as an actual historical event. Let me introduce you just briefly to a guy with a lot of faith here, Johan Hubers in the Netherlands. Several years ago, he built a 1/5 scale size Noah's Ark, and this has been viewed by tens of thousands of people in the Netherlands at different sites that he's brought it to. Here's what it looks like on the inside. I don't like his big elephants in there, but I'll give him, you know, a pass on that one. And here he is, and he's just a businessman, and he wanted to show that the Bible is true, so he decided he was going to do this project. And in fact, it went so well that he is actually working on a full-sized Noah's Ark. And this is, there's no organization behind this. This is a businessman, one guy who has started this and helping with his family. And of course, others have joined in on the project now. But he intends this to be ready in the summer of this year. He actually intends to bring it all around the world to all the different continents to be there at the coinciding with various important events on those continents, you know, over the next decade. So you talk about a guy with a big dream doing a big thing for God. This is a guy. I mean, this, you know, this is amazing. But even locally now here in Cincinnati, the Answers in Genesis, in association with another group, is developing plans to build a full-size Noah's Ark in the Cincinnati area as part of a theme park, which will have other biblical exhibits also. So that should be pretty interesting. So I think you're going to be hearing a lot about Noah's Ark in the news, right, over the next several years due to things like this going on. So what can we say in conclusion? Well, first, the flood is necessary because we have to explain that geologic column. I've heard it said if the Bible didn't have a global flood in it, we'd have to make it up. We'd have to make it up because we have to explain that geologic column somehow. Next, we've seen that there is historical, physical evidence consistent with a global flood and that it is, in fact, feasible that an ark could have been built and housed animals, food, and water. And it is feasible that they could have been cared for by only 8 people. So continuous miracles were not necessary, but certainly God was involved. Why? Because God is involved in everything that we do, right? So I'm sure God sent his angels and had that ark, you know, going in a good spot at the right time. But how do we know that God is not nudging our car as we drive down Route 9, making sure we're keeping in the lane? And I have to think that the angels work overtime on the parkway, right? You got these metal boxes going 60 miles an hour or more, a few feet from each other. It's amazing that people aren't crashing every few miles, right? Well, maybe God is and his angels are, you know, helping out with that situation. So, but the point is, it's a feasible thing. You know, God always has a part in everything, but he also gives us a part to do, and we think that that's what's happened here. So we have to get this idea out of our heads that this event is just a story, which means it's a myth, and instead replace that by a realistic view of the ark and that this is real history. It really happened. Now, has Noah's ark been found? No. But I got to have to tell you this. If there was one place on the earth where you could hide the ark or the remnants of it for, you know, 4,500 years, it would be a place like Mount Ararat. Why? Because it's in a very politically sensitive area. You have to get special permits to go there. The weather's always bad. It's very rough terrain. It's a huge space. So if you were going to hide it anywhere, that's where it would be hidden. You're not going to put it in New Jersey because we would have found it by now, right? So I personally believe, and many other creation scientists do also, that near the end of time, God will in fact reveal the ark or the remnants of it as yet another sign. Hey, world, you know, Bible is true, you know, giving you another warning sign here, right? So back in that day, God had judgment on the world, but he provided a way to be saved from that judgment. As we saw, the ark had plenty of space on it. Anyone could have gone up that gangway, got into the ark, and have been saved from that judgment. And it's really a sad shame that no one did, but they didn't. But today, we know that God will be judging our present world, is he not? But today, God has given us a different way to be saved, and that is by placing our faith and our trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. So judgment will come again, but God has provided a way again for us to be saved. It was not going to be hard for someone to go up that gangplank and into the ark to be saved. Likewise, God has made it easy for us to be saved. I outlined the simple steps there. It's really the ABCs. You've probably heard them before. We need to admit first that we are sinners, and I hope no one needs to be convinced of that. Next, we need to believe that Jesus has died for our sins, that he is indeed the Savior, and we need to repent of our sins, to be sorry for them. It doesn't mean we won't ever do them again. We probably will. But we need to be sorry that we are sinners. And finally, we need to confess that Jesus is Lord. And if we do these very simple things, we, in fact, will then be saved of the coming judgment. So this guy here, he literally missed a boat. Right? He missed the boat. And today, what some people talked about yesterday didn't happen. So we have a chance now. If you've been thinking about this, you have a chance now before it is too late to take advantage of this free offer to be saved from the judgment that God will be instituting on mankind. You don't know how long you're going to live. You know, we don't know. It could be many years. Today may be your last day. So why put it off? If you're ready for this, you do it today. You tell Jesus in your heart that you want to be a Christian. You talk about the ABCs here and go through them. Look at it for yourself and study it because you don't want to miss the boat. You don't want to be like that guy looking back saying, oh, man, I knew I should have and he didn't, right? So you want to, while you're sitting here living and breathing and have the opportunity, you want